Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 20th of March 2016. My name's TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Johnny Fox, Nick from Partnership Circuit Review and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about The Painkiller at the Garrick Theatre. This is part of Kenneth Branagh's season at the Garrick Theatre, and stars Kenneth Branagh along with Rob Brydon, Marcus Fraser, Claudie Blakely, Mark Hadfield and Alex McQueen. It's based on, I think it's a stage play that was very quickly made into a film, in fact made into a film twice, called Le Merdeur, which is presumably some form of assassin, I think, and directed by Sean Foley, who did I Can't Sing in the West End a couple of years ago. The setup is fairly obvious for a farce, I think, and in some ways fairly typical. You have two adjoining hotel rooms. There is a door that joins them together. They happen to look out onto different parts of a street. One looks out into a car park and the other looks out into the entrance to a court. There is going to be a trial and there is an important person who needs assassination. We're not entirely certain whether this person's a bad guy or an important witness or what they are, but we know there's a lot of fuss about it and there's a lot of security because it gets mentioned very early. So it is set up. One man is an attempted assassin and the other man is, well, he's a kind of failed photographer who is feeling fairly suicidal. His wife has left him for her psychotherapist and his life's gone absolutely nowhere. He's constantly trying to ring up his wife. These characters, the assassin is played by Kenneth Branagh, the rather sad photographer is played by Rob Brydon, and the other character we see the most of is probably Vincent, or Vincent the hotel porter, played by Mark Hadfield, who's only just come out of a rather splendid play downstairs at the Hampstead Theatre called The Meeting, which unfortunately we weren't able to talk about. In this play, it is fairly simple. The setup, as with any farce, which is what this is that their lives get entwined. Kenneth Branagh's assassin is trying to carry out his contract, and he unfortunately gets involved with Rob Brydon's character's suicide attempt, and there are slight misunderstandings, which means that Kenneth Branagh's character gets drugged, and there's mistaken identities. And I found it fairly obvious farce and fairly simple in the way it was done, and it's a fairly mechanical one. It has been heavily adapted from the French version, but I kind of wanted it to remain more French. I think they work better. You know, a French comedy tends to work better if you leave it as French, but with an English accent, as it were, that everybody is playing French people, but they're using their own accents, and we're not in an episode of Hello, Hello. It seems to work a lot better when you keep it in France rather than trying to transpose it. I mean, we're in some identified place in London, and everything's a bit too close, so you can sort of summon the psychiatrist or summon somebody back from the riding lesson, and that sort of works inside a 90-minute play. And anybody who knows London, these little things bother you, like you can't get across London that quickly, you don't have the views that people want to have of courtrooms and stuff like that if you're in London. So, you know, my knowledge of London geography, having lived here for 30 years, is too good for this play to really feel that it works. And I think the original film on which it's based is based in Montpellier, so it's a much smaller city than vast sprawling London with all the traffic jams. So you don't feel that people could drop in and out of this hotel. I think the performances overall from Kenneth Branagh and Rob Brydon, they are pretty good. I think they need to be much more adept at the physical comedy, and I'm not sure that they were quite that. You do have a very good performance from Mark Hadfield as the porter, because, I mean, he just seems to be a natural at this sort of thing and is very good at his job. There's a nice performance, I thought, from Alex McQueen as the psychotherapist, who really is just there to be angry and to make a mistake, which means you get a lot of Kenneth Branagh wandering around unable to speak half the time. But Claudie Blakely is a little bit wasted as the disappointed wife. You know, there is a trope in theatre, all drama actually, of the disappointed wife. It's a comedy staple, and it's a very boring comedy staple, and can we not have it anymore, please? So I did think she was kind of wasted in there. People around me, I think, were having a pretty good time. I don't think they were absolutely rapturous about it. The other thing I would say is that the design by Alice Power, who designed the set and costume, although it's a very good representation of a hotel room, there was a slight problem for me in the logic of it. Basically, you've got these two windows. They are important parts of the plot because the assassin needs one of them. And obviously there's a bit of falling out of windows and presumably crawling along ledges. But the actual mechanics of that didn't make sense. Basically, they would have had to go along the fourth wall. And if you're sitting really far back in the stalls, as I was, it didn't make sense geographically. The idea of them crawling along the ledges or whatever they were going to do to get from one window to another, I just didn't buy it. And it kind of took me out of it in a way. But I think I was feeling slightly uncomfortable with this play. I don't know. I wanted something sharper and crisper and a lot more funny and a lot more nasty, a good solid French farce. Francis Weber has a wonderful track record, it would appear, from before this. I mean, he does a few plays, but his main work is as a screenwriter and director. And he's done an awful lot of plays that would be familiar if you know your films. There are things like The Toy, which was a lot of them were remakes, and I'll talk about the remakes rather than the original French versions, but you do a French version of a film, you get an American remake. So you get an American remake of a film called The Toy, which had Richard Pryor in it. You have The Man with One Red Shoe, which had Tom Hanks in it. Another play with The Three Fugitives, which I think had Nick Nolte and Martin Short in it. And even more recently, you have Dinner for Schmucks, which is a remake of his The Dîner de Cons with Steve Carell in it. The Dinner or the Dinner for Schmucks play was done in the West End in 2003 with Nigel Havers and Ardal O'Hanlon, among others. It was done in the West End as See You Next Tuesday, which was a rather obvious title. The thing about that play, when I saw it about 13 years ago now, I think it was a bit of a flop. It was mildly disappointing. And I think The Painkiller falls into the same place. What do you think about it, Gareth?
Well, I think I'm probably more positive about it than you are, even though farce isn't really my genre, as it were. The last couple of farces I remember seeing I didn't enjoy, and that was A Flea in Her Ear at the Old Vic and An Absolute Turkey, the Peter Hall Company. But both were Fado farces, which I think predate this by quite a number of years. Although I have enjoyed the kind of subversions of the form that we've had in Michael Frayn's Noises Off, revived comparatively recently, and in, of course, Mischief Theatre's Goes Wrong series with A Play That Goes Wrong and Peter Pan Goes Wrong. And I found this probably the most frenetic farce I've ever seen, and quite possibly one of the most frenetic farces the West End has ever seen, if they've ever seen one that's more frenetic than this before. And I kind of started with misgivings, really. I really had never heard of Weber, I knew nothing about him whatsoever, so I just went cold. But I was aware that the reviews of the early production of this with the same lead pair in Belfast about 5 years ago hadn't gone down terribly well. But I wanted to give it a go because Kenneth Branagh and Rob Brydon was a pairing I was rather attracted by, to be honest. And I started with misgivings, but actually I did actually succumb to its profound silliness, but above all, I think, to the skill. And I think I probably saw a later preview than you did. So maybe by then the sort of physical comedy was slicker because I thought it was very, very slick. So I actually surprised myself in a way in how much I enjoyed it. And the audience, I mean, I think it is a love or hate show. And I was interesting to walk into the tube afterwards, listening to people who clearly hated it. But also, you know, there were an awful lot of people around me having the time of their lives. And I think on balance, even though it's a love or hate show, I think more people will love it than hate it. You know, it is a silly, it is farce. So it's kind of silly and daft. And that's what I suppose farce always is, really. But it's the skill of it that, as I said, that blew me away, really. And it is quite exhausting to watch. It must be pretty exhausting to play. You know, Kenneth Branagh proved in Harlequinade, if we didn't know already, that he had great comic timing. And now, of course, he's adding in physical comedy. I've certainly never seen him do physical comedy before, and I think it's masterly what he does. And Rob Brydon, he is actually playing the hapless Welshman, which you've seen quite a lot, notably in the TV series Marion and Jeff, the sort of monologue he did. But here, with the added physical comedy, I mean, I think that's added to great effect, really. And you mentioned Mark Hadfield. I think, again, a great track record in comedy. He's done musicals, he's done comedy, but he's also done farce. I can recall one of the many A Chocolate Factory when one of the old Ben Travers farces, Rookery Nook, when he was very, very good in that. But here, funnily enough, he doesn't have the physical demands of the others, and he has to rely on body language and facial expressions and the odd kind of movement. But in doing that, actually does bring the house down. So I thought he was outstanding. Alex McQueen plays a psychiatrist. Marcus Fraser is having his professional debut as a policeman, which is quite an auspicious professional debut, I'd have thought, in this company. And Claudia Blakely, really, it's difficult for her, I think, because it isn't a comedic role. I mean, it's almost like a straight man. She basically doesn't have a comedy role. I don't think she has any laughs, really. I completely agree with you that I thought the set was very clever, but the thing that just irritated me throughout was the fact that when they go out one window, you know that's not possible because the way the set is configured, without saying any more than that. And that, to say, did kind of irritate me a little bit. That's probably me being a bit pedantic about it. But anyway, I think it's not a genre I'm mad keen on. However, it won me over. I think it is, you know, farce has become deeply unfashionable, to be honest, and I think is therefore, you know, a bit of an endangered species. So in some ways, I think it's quite good to see the Branagh Company letting its hair down in this way and bringing back a good, more modern example of the form so well executed, because Sean Foley, as you know, is a director who is very good at this sort of stuff. And of course, they're turning round here because Kenneth Branagh directed Sean Foley in the Morecambe and Wise homage, and Ducktastic, which followed it, the play what I wrote in Ducktastic. And now Foley is directing Kenneth Branagh in this. So, much to my surprise, an evening I actually rather enjoyed.
We're now going to talk about Miss Atomic Bomb at the St James's Theatre. This is a brand new musical written by Adam Long, Gabriel Vick and Alex Jackson Long, co-directed by Adam Long with Bill Deemer, who is also the choreographer. I think kind of the two big stars in this are Catherine Tate and Simon Lipkin, although we also have Dean John Wilson, Daniel Boys, Florence Andrews, and yet another Strallen. Sassy is this one. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I think what I thought of it is that you really shouldn't put bomb in the title of a musical, because it makes it such a soft target for critics. And they were really scampering to their keyboards to say it bombed. I mean, it's not often that theatre reviews are bad enough to make the BBC lunchtime headlines, but the morning after press night, the writers of Miss Atomic Bomb really should have been donning their tin hats. And I think the prime example is a man I think of as London's most enthusiastic musical theatre critic, and someone who is enormously supportive of new writing, Mark Shenton, co-chief critic of The Stage, who had just chaired the BEAM event at the Park Theatre, which is all about, you know, two-day workshop, all about encouraging new musical writing, was out of his seat like a rocket to get a one-star review online by midnight. So something must be wrong with this show, because it's been in development for 5 years. And what distresses me, really, because I went to Miss Atomic Bomb really hoping it would be absolutely wonderful and, you know, a real kick in the stalls, is that there is no opportunity to see it, comment on it, or guide it, or anything that critics might be able to do before it emerges fully formed. I wish I had been to a workshop and seen this in development. And I think, you know, it could be that it's the kind of, it's not written by committee, but it is produced and directed and written by a whatever the four version of triumvirate is for three gents and a lady. And possibly it's their collective enthusiasm for so many references to other musicals and musical styles that perhaps defeats Miss Atomic Bomb coming out as one cohesive piece. Which is a shame, because there is a great story to be told here, and it is there. It's just drowned a little bit in variety, I think is the word. I don't know how many of you remember the American humorist Tom Lehrer. Was he a mathematician or something like that, who also turned to satirical comedy in his 40s or something like that? And he wrote a wonderful song called "So Long, Mom, I'm Off to Drop the Bomb, So Don't Wait Up for Me." And in one 90-second lyric, he satirised all that US nuclear showboating in the 60s and the commie-baiting Cold War and the idea that if there was a Third World War, it'd be over in 90 minutes. So much more effectively than, you know, what span out to like 2¾ hours of this musical. But it is a splendid original subject, and the shattering true story, as there often is behind frothy musicals, quite a horrific story, is that American soldiers were ordered into the primary fallout zone to test the effects of radiation. And this is ghastly. This is, you know, nobody would be allowed to do that now. But, you know, they were more or less sacrificed. And then the other kind of amusing thing, which, again, the show does work on, is the fact that the Nevada test site, which only operated for a few years, but certainly made mushroom clouds visible from Las Vegas, sort of put Las Vegas on the tourist map. I know that in Nevada they'd kind of legalized gambling, which obviously was what made Las Vegas be created, and Studs Terkel and so on to found their big hotels and casinos. But it brought a lot more people there for the first time. Now, just in terms of structure, yes, there's a narrative, but it keeps being interrupted and in some ways overwhelmed by what I can only think of as a succession of comic turns, prime amongst which is Catherine Tate. And, you know, for a woman of her skill and experience and quality, I mean, she was a tremendous performer. You know, you watch her on television and you see the originality in her sketch writing and her characterizations and so on. And in that format, I have enormous admiration for her. I think she's tremendous. She also looks wonderful and she sings strongly. It's not a case of someone who's got telecredentials being squeezed into a musical just because they'll drag the bums onto the seats. She actually is a very capable singer. I don't think she should have borrowed a push-up bra from Jessica Rabbit because she looks a little bit squeezed and her character's meant to be a fashion designer, so they've made her totter about the Nevada desert in 5-inch stilettos, which also makes her on-stage presence a little bit awkward, but nothing like as awkward as her accent, which, you know, that song, it could walk all the way from Boulder to Birmingham, but it also takes a pretty lengthy detour through the Australian outback. In fact, a detour as long as Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. What she needs to do is have a word with the director and say, look, he's just put a line in here that says, I'm a Greek character, but actually I come from Melbourne. And then all the accent problems would be solved. But her character is divergent from the tenor of the rest of the piece, which is really very strong 50s pastiche. You know, London likes that sort of thing. What do we have, isn't it? Casa Valentina and Grey Gardens, you know. Oh, and now Welcome Home, Captain Fox, happily set in that kind of vibrant Doris Day, big-skirted 50s, which looks great and is fantastic for a musical, because there's a lot of good music from that period that you could pastiche. So why do they do Bublil and Schoenberg? I didn't get that. You mentioned some of the leading characters, Tim, but somebody with a very big following is Daniel Boyes. Very good singer, very nice young man. Wasn't he wonderful in Avenue Q? Here he's playing a very odd part as an uncaring mortgage repo man come to repossess, I'm not sure it's Catherine Tate's or her friend's trailer out in the desert on a farm. But in so doing it, he's been encouraged to impersonate Inspector Javert from Les Misérables. And when he sings the song about, I've come to repossess your trailer, and he reads out the number of the mortgage deed, you know, he does it as if it was Valjean's 24601 and gives it the full Russell Crowe. It's great. But isn't it ludicrous to employ a pastiche of the distinctive 80s music of Bublil and Schoenberg in a show set in 1951 when they were variously 7 and 10 years old? I didn't get that. There's something else that's really, really worth praising. Well, I think anyway, and somebody else thinks. Paul and I sat directly in front of Elaine Page. Don't worry, the auditorium's very steeply raked, even she could see. And at the end, she was saying, not how terrific she thought the show was, but how terrific she thought Florence Andrews, who plays the young lead, was. She plays a character called Candy Johnson, who is a Utah-raised farm girl who has come to seek her fame and fortune in Nevada and by a process of complicated comedy becomes a candidate in the Miss Atomic Bomb contest. She's amazing. I mean, she really is someone that we have to look to in the future when a role in perhaps a more familiar musical comes available. I mean, in Pigtails and Dungaree, she looks exactly like Ellie Mae Clampett from the Beverly Hillbillies. But she sings both her country and western numbers, and there's a kind of My Grandma torch song, just divinely. I mean, really is a dramatically good potential leading lady and one to watch. She's in the plot, has a love interest with a soldier who has deserted from this instruction to go march into the Mushroom Cloud, played by Dean John Wilson. who's been very good in some of the compilation shows that they've done here at the St. James's, apart from anywhere else, and is shortly to be Aladdin in the Disney blockbuster. And I felt as if he was slightly walking through it. He's okay, but he's completely eclipsed by his big brother, who plays the hotel manager of the place where they have the Miss Atomic Bomb contest, played absolutely to the hilt by Simon Lipkin. And, you know, here you have another enormously capable leading man deserving of better material, or certainly material which will earn him a wider audience. You know, I could so see him playing Sidney Falco in The Sweet Smell of Success. But as we often say, you know, aren't the ensemble wonderful? They have to be nutty professors, bad drag queens, Vegas showgirls in three different shades of Betty Grable wig. They have to be pantomime mobsters, sheep shearers on the farm, and all that yes sirree American soldiery. And there's only about 12 of them, and they really do a fantastic job. It's wonderful that you mentioned that the littlest Strallen. She's actually my favourite. Cece Strallen, I've seen in the ensemble of lots of things at the Union, and I think upstairs at the Gatehouse and a couple of other places as well. And nobody works any harder than she does. I mean, she plays about 9 different ladies in this, and she's variously herself, you know, a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead. And bless Wig Specialities Limited for the huge number of pieces that they've provided. So I think if the ensemble deserves anything, it deserves 5 stars for putting its heart into its job, because they really, really do. And it's unfortunate that the balance of the show is such that it isn't completely a 5-star show, and certainly professional critics didn't agree. So, Nick, what did you think of it?
I went in a couple of nights after the reviews, and I hadn't... I mean, you know, it's hard to miss the amount of stars that are or haven't been given out to something, but I don't like to read reviews. But I'd also kind of, there was definitely a feel on Twitter that something wasn't right here. And to me, it's trying really hard, and it just fails every time. I think, like you say, it's trying too many things. When you come to try and write a review of it, and you try to describe what the plot is, and you're kind of struggling, and you've written about 3 times as much as you'd normally write on a normal review before you've even started to describe what's going on. But as well as kind of the amount of story they're trying to cobble together, there are just so many different styles of comedy. And actually, I haven't really read the reviews yet either, but it does sound like there's been quite a lot of really gunning for this. And I'm not sure how you could, because despite the fact that it just didn't work, I really wanted it to, you know, throughout. It's kind of, it felt like this show that the whole audience was willing to work, and it just, you know, it just disappointed you every single time. I mean, I was near the edge of the second row, which it's like curved at the front of the St. James, so I could actually see the faces of a lot of the audience. And, I mean, there wasn't really, you know, it's looking bored or, you know, there wasn't any animosity towards it. Everybody was looking a bit confused. I think everybody looked about as unsure what they were doing there as half the cast did. But, you know, there was kind of smiles, but there was no laughter. There was one little gang of excitable laughter, especially in the second half after they'd had a drink. And I think it was probably somebody's friends, as you often do get. You start to know the sound of one of the cast's groups of friends laughing at everything they do. But other than that, just none of the jokes landed. And I could hear, you know, in the interval and afterwards, people talking about it, and nobody thought it was any good, but nobody really felt any animosity towards it. Everybody kind of wanted it to have been good, and you can't kind of... I don't know how you could be too mean about this, because it's trying so hard, and it's just failing every time. You can see in a lot of the leading actors that they're not maybe putting their best work into this. You know, I feel kind of sorry for Daniel Boyce, because his character is a Javert pastiche, which I think not necessarily anybody, well, certainly nobody found it funny the first time. And unfortunately, that is literally all there is to the character. He just keeps coming back, doing another bit of Javert pastiche and going away again. And nobody laughed the first time, so nobody's going to laugh the next 7 times. And he does seem to have been getting stroppy with people on Twitter for not quite getting that joke. I think including with you, John. And yeah, it's one of these shows that's kind of, they're aiming for a sort of irreverence, a sort of dark humour in there. And I think just there's something about the balance of it that just nothing works, unfortunately. And it's a real shame. Catherine Tate is not, you know, her accent aside, her heart doesn't seem into it until the very end. that was the highlight for me, was the big duet between Catherine Tate and Simon Lipkin, the kind of spoof, kind of inversion of a big love song at the end, which is probably the one gag that kind of works. And I did suspect, because, I mean, she has said, Catherine Tate, that she agreed to do this without reading the script first. And I wondered if... Well, she apparently claims that she always does that. She never reads a script before signing up for something.
Well, I think she was on fairly safe ground with assassins, wasn't she? I
mean, well, yes, exactly.
These people had heard of that.
But this is what I mean, is I think, actually, that maybe the reason she was there was because she'd worked a little bit with Simon Lipkin in Assassins, and, you know, maybe she was told, you know, she had this role that was sort of a not quite interest with him, and that they'd get a couple of good scenes together. I did wonder, from the fact that both of their game kind of... I mean, actually, Simon Lipkin's game is good throughout. He's always someone who can really make anything funny, but as I've said, not quite anything, because he's just not got the material here.
Mm. I think this was developed on the back of the Chocolate Factory, wasn't it? There are credits in the programme for David Babani, and thanks to everybody at the Menier Chocolate Factory. So either they provided some kind of workshopping facilities or I don't think rehearsal space, but I do think that they were somehow involved in the sort of fostering of the development of the musical.
Well, very possibly. But, you know, like I say, I think that's kind of the one point where it comes to life, which made me think maybe that's the reason she's there, is that she wanted to work to have some, kind of some better scenes with Simon Lipkin, because his character, obviously, in Assassins is not someone who's that directly involved with any of the others. It is a strong cast, and I think that maybe there's a few favours being called in getting some of these names in there. And, you know, it does feel like a shame to me that it doesn't work. It's not, you know, I didn't come out of there thinking, oh, I'm going to rip this apart, because, you know, it was... Sometimes no. You do. Sometimes something's been done for the wrong reasons. You feel like something's desperately money-grabbing. And it doesn't feel like that to me. It feels like a labour of love that just has not worked on any level. It's a shame, you know, you just sit there kind of going, this just doesn't work. Paul, what do you think?
I agree with both of you. I think you could spend all the time talking about the various different plot points in this show. I think what it probably needs is some ruthless editing and shaping after this run to sort of give it a much more coherent story. And I also agree that when things focus ultimately and regrettably a bit too late in the show towards the Tate and Lipkin relationship, it gets a lot more stronger and sharper. And I think that's the focus between Tate and Lipkin and Dean John Wilson's character and Florence Andrews, you know, could have given this show a much sharper focus rather than all the other superfluous things. But, you know, I agree. You're watching it and you actually want it to work because the cast are terrific and the ensemble are, you know, singing and dancing their socks off. So you can't dislike it as much as I think the critics have come away with. But I think, having said that, you know, it does need a lot more work. And had this actually been, it's great that St. James is showcasing new works, but had it been sort of presented more as a piece, as a work in development, I think it might have got a different reaction. Because I think, you know, it should be presented more as a work in progress. Having said that, cast was terrific. It looks great. There's some very wonderful projections happening in the background, which it's tempting to feel vertigo depending on where you're sitting in the St. James from watching them move. But, you know, Florence Andrews is incredible. She's got a strong dramatic number in the second half singing about her grandmother, but it actually really feels misplaced as though it's in the wrong show. And I think also Daniel Boy's playing this Javert-like mortgage repo man. He's kind of wasted in this piece. And also, there's this rich story that's in here about people that, you know, went to Vegas just to watch these atomic blasts, but also the whole stories about whole townships were destroyed through being downwind of these nuclear testing, where two-headed lambs were being born and all that sort of stuff, that, you know, they could have mined. And with the benefit of time, they could have mined it for comedy. So I think it was a bit of a wasted opportunity in some respects, and it's being billed as a new British musical, but I suspect it's not going to be one in its current form that is going to be remembered. But perhaps in the future, if they represent it in a much more sharper way, it could have a future to it, once they work out what the story is about and a much more coherent musical style to it.
Les Miserables, that, you know, the critics hated it, and then it turned out to be a commercial success. That doesn't seem to be happening yet, because it's very heavily discounted.
Yeah, well, it's definitely worth seeing for the cast anyway, and if you're a fan of any of the cast members, I think, you know, Catherine Tate, Simon Lipkin, they're funny even without even saying anything. So, you know, it's worth seeing them in it for that. But, you know, perhaps if it is reworked in the future, maybe it will be a fascinating piece of musical theatre history then to have seen.
Yeah, I'm sure it will.
I think if it is reworked, though, I think it'll have to be like Carrie, which kind of took a couple of decades to be revisited, because I think it's going to be overshadowed by the reaction, and it clearly hasn't got, it's not kind of found this popular reaction, like you say, that Les Mis did. I think it's going to be remembered as this massive flop. And, you know, like I say, it doesn't mean it can't be reworked and become a hit in 20 years' time. But I think that is what we're looking at, because I think it's any sooner and all people are going to go is that was that massive flop.
Maybe it needs more sheep blood then. Just thinking Carrie had pig blood.
No, one thing it doesn't need any more of is references to sheep.
I did like the dead sheep, though.
No, yeah, that's fair enough, but it was the use of the word sheep as a punchline about 47 times.
Oh,
out of context.
And Dean John Wilson brandishing a zucchini, I think. Now that's something you don't see every day either.
We're now going to talk about German Scaries at the Orange Tree Theatre. This is a 1977 play by Robert Holman and is directed here by Alice Hamilton with a design by James Perkins. The cast is George Evans, who plays Jack, Howard Ward, who plays Martin, Katie Moore, who plays Carol, and Henry Emmett plays Michael. It's a fairly gentle story, I think. There's some quite shocking bits in it, but it's really the gentle tale of perhaps some bird-watching folk, you might say. Nick, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Robert Holman is someone who has been hugely influential on kind of other playwrights, particularly David Eldridge and Simon Stevens, who've also worked with him. But I think apart from that play they wrote together a few years ago, A Thousand Stars Explode in the Sky, I hadn't seen any of his work, and he was pretty much absent from, certainly in London, the stage, up until Making Noise Quietly at the Donmar a few years ago. And I think it's ironic, because although the critics kind of raved about Making Noise Quietly, I don't know really anyone else who liked it. I found it incredibly boring. And so did pretty much everyone I spoke to about it. But funnily enough, that sort of started a new interest in his work. And we've had some of his new plays, and we've had some revivals of some of his old plays, and obviously this is the latter. And actually, I don't like to dismiss a writer on the basis of one play. So I have kind of given him other chances, and I think it has kind of paid off. I think the thing with Robert Holman is he is so low-key that either you're going to be kind of very quietly moved by what's going on, or you're going to be incredibly bored by it. And with me, it can go both ways. I think now I've seen more of his plays that I've liked than I haven't. And this one, it's not my favourite of his, but I did enjoy German Scaries. It takes place on sort of the mouth of the River Tees. And the name is from some skerries that are fairly hazardous, and they got their name when a Luftwaffe pilot in the Second World War crashed and got killed by them. And now they're more a good place to spot cormorants. So the whole thing takes place in this little promontory, which has got a good view for bird watchers. And so what you've got there, as is actually a common theme, I think, in Holman's work, you've got a younger man and an older man have a conversation. And the younger man is Jack, played by George Evans, and he's a bird watcher who's quietly sitting there when the older man, Martin, who's Howard Ward, comes along with his bike to put it away in a little shed that they've got there for sort of members of the nature reserve or whatever it is. And Martin's kind of quite chatty and talking to him. And later we meet Jack's wife, who's played by Katie Moore. And there's also a small role of a steel worker who's a friend of Martin's, and he's played by Henry Everett. And we briefly see him in the opening scene, and then there's kind of closest thing to a major incident in the play involves him. And they're not the easiest plays to kind of talk about, because they're very kind of deliberately vague, and You know, they don't kind of jump out at you with their themes. They're incredibly subtle. But there's sort of in the background, you start building up this idea that it's about people's potential and about kind of spreading your wings and not being confined necessarily to the place that you were born in. And there's kind of one little speech from Martin that I found kind of quite quietly moving, which is he's telling Jack, if he ever has kids, that, you know, teach them to love you, but not to feel indebted to you. They're not the same thing. It's something like that. And that was, for me, kind of one of the, kind of in some way, what the play is about. But I think, as with any Robert Holman play, it is either going to just kind of catch on something for you that works for you and that means something for you, or it's not, and it's just going to be really dull for you. For me, this worked, and, you know, it was worth popping out to Richmond to see. But I can understand that it won't be to everybody's taste. Gareth, what did you think?
I've seen a handful of Robert Holman plays. I mean, he's been very prolific, because he's written something like 24 plays over the last 40 years. And he's had a lot of them produced by sort of pretty Premier League organisations, really. I mean, he's had quite a lot of them produced by the RSC and the Royal Court and the Bush. And indeed, this play was first seen in 1977 at the Bush. And as you say, he's often considered the sort of the playwrights, really, and people like Simon Stevens and David Aldridge sort of cite him as an influence. I found the play didn't really go anywhere for me. And I know the area quite a bit from the sort of in terms of the industrial aspects of the area, because the plant where Jack actually works is somewhere where I've been to 20, 30 times to work in the last 20 years or so. So it's an area I sort of got to know fairly well. And I do think they kind of capture the decline of the industrial landscape, as it were, I mean, over that period of time. I mean, the Wilton plant, which he works at, you know, used to employ tens of thousands of people, and it's now split up into 50 or more companies, employees, a fraction of that number. Jack is a character that I just couldn't believe in. I don't know what it was about him, but I just didn't believe in him as a character and what was kind of happening in his life. And that was pretty fundamental to the play for me. And because I didn't believe in him, I think the play lost me. It's very wistful, but it doesn't go anywhere. And it's nice writing, and it's beautifully directed. I mean, Alice Hammond's got a few plays like this, as she showed with the two Barney Norris plays, The Visitors and Eventide. And I think it's very cleverly designed for In the Round, or rather In the Square, The Orange Tree by James Perkins, and I quite like that design. And indeed, apart from Jack, which I'm a bit ambivalent about, I thought all the performances were very good. But I was just understimulated, I think, really. The main character lost me. I was understimulated, and frankly, I was just a bit bored. So I kind of just didn't engage with it, and I was disappointed by the evening. And when I look back at my experiences with Robert Holman, I found, as time goes on, I've kind of lost a bit of patience with him. And I mean, I liked Making Noise Quietly when I first saw it, but then when I got to see it at the Donmouth, I thought, what was the fuss all about? And as time has gone on, I've sort of got less interested in his plays. Perhaps I'm just more demanding as an audience member. I want more things happening. Or perhaps it's just he and I, we're just not compatible anymore. I've given him the nickname of the Gisborough Chekhov. He was born in the same year as me, and he's from Gisborough, so I've decided to call him the Gisborough Chekhov, because I think he does have this very Chekhovian style, although fortunately not 3.5 hours long as our most recent Chekhov was. So I was disappointed, frankly. Things I liked about it, but overall I was disappointed.
I thought, as people have been saying, it's well acted, it's, you know, it's decently written, but nothing happens. And that is a problem. I mean, things actually, obviously things do happen, but they almost seem incidental to the play. They're not actually driving anything. There's no real driving force for the play, other than that maybe one of the characters kind of gets his act together and kind of makes a few decisions, but you never really felt that there was anything hanging on that, or is it that there's anything, you know, that his life is going to be a disaster if he doesn't make the decision, or if he makes the wrong decision it's all going to go terrible, or it's going to rescue him. You don't feel that. You're just not interested enough in them. But it is I think it's a very good production, and, you know, in terms of the direction as you say, the design and the performances. But yeah, you just thought, is that it? At the end of the play, you know, you couldn't quite feel that it's really got you and bitten you and done something. I remember Jonah Renotto. I'm not sure if we did Jenner Otto in the podcast. We certainly did Making Noise Quietly back in 2012. But I can't remember, because that was one of the most recent ones I saw. I don't think we did Breakfast of Eels, which is the most recent ones. But the most recent one we talked about, I think we might have talked about, and certainly one I saw, was Jenner Otto of Robert Holman's plays. That was much odder, but pretty much the same thing. An older man imparts his wisdom to a younger man who is changed and moves on in many ways. I mean, they're almost companion pieces in some ways, this one and Jenner and Otto. He does seem to... If I think about the first one of his plays I saw, without really knowing the name, I saw a play called Rafts and Dreams, which had A.D. Allen and Jason Watkins and Jonathan Cullen in it, upstairs at the Royal Court in 1990. And I still remember things about that play. I still remember little things in about that play, and more things happened. I mean, after all, that was, I think, the idea that the whole world had flooded and people were simply stuck on improvised rafts made from their roofs. I think that was the general idea of the play. So it was a strange, almost science fiction-y tale, Rafts and Dreams, and much more rewarding in many ways than this play, which is, as I think we've all been saying, well done, and certainly you can see some quality there, but it just doesn't go anywhere. It's just, there's not enough oomph there, perhaps, not enough story. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.